Although the U.S. has not recognized China's new claim, the State Department on Friday said it had advised U.S. airlines to comply with China's demand for advance notification of any flights through a new air defense identification zone, which Chinese officials first declared on November 23rd. State Department spokeswoman Jen Psaki said U.S. air carriers were being advised to take all steps they consider necessary to operate safely in the East China Sea region. The recent extension of China's air defense identification zone, referred to in that news report, is just the latest modification of its relations with the U.S. and other nations. For about 50 years, the U.S. has had to concern itself with the dual threat of the Communist Soviet Union and Red China. Now that both countries have gone through considerable political and economic change, what are the prospects for relations with the U.S.? I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Our guest is Howard Schwaber, professor of political science at the UW-Madison, who recently spent 2 years in the former Soviet Republic's Kazakhstan. This hour, we talk about Russia, China, and future relations with the United States.
Welcome back.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Just in the last few days, we have riots in Ukraine, pretty significant ones, regarding the relations between Ukraine and the European Union. And we have also the expansion of Chinese airspace. What's going on?
When we originally talked about doing this show, I'd assumed it would be about general background material. In the last 5 or 6 days, events have been happening very, very fast. So let's start with Ukraine, which I think is exactly the right place to start if you're talking about Russia. Right now, there are riots in Independence Square. The number of people involved over the weekend has been estimated anywhere from 300,000 to a million. These are crowds on the scale of the Orange Revolution of 2004 that overthrew a prior regime.
And is that a first-time thing in Ukraine? Is this unique, or has it happened?
Well, since the Orange Revolution, it's unique. It's different in that in the Orange Revolution, what was being called for was the restoration of the outcome of an election that had been fairly blatantly stolen by the guy currently in charge, Yanukovych. This one is much more deep-rooted in the sense that what the protesters are asking for is a change in the direction of the country in a very fundamental way. A little background is probably helpful there. So let me go back to the fall of the Soviet Union. Let's take 1991. I think it's important for American listeners to recognize that the countries of Central Asia in particular didn't have revolutions. They didn't overthrow the Soviet yoke and chase them out. The Soviet Union kind of dissolved around them. And Ukraine is somewhat in that position. It's not like Lithuania or Estonia, where there was a massive nationalist resurgence to get rid of all vestiges of Russian influence. Estonia had a wonderful thing called the War on Monuments, where people just went around tearing down all the statues from the Soviet era. In Ukraine, there's still, particularly in eastern Ukraine, strong ties to Russia, a large Russophilic and Russian-speaking population. To this day, there is a considerable population that in some ways is nostalgic for the old days. So it's a very, very different environment from, say, Poland. Second, so that's one important observation. The other really important observation is that the pipelines that carry Russian natural gas to Europe pretty much all go through Ukraine. About 20% go through Moldova, which is also a relevant state here. So Ukraine is a critical transit state. During the Soviet period, the Soviets set up a system whereby raw materials, raw fuel, petroleum and gas, would be brought from the periphery countries into Russia for processing, then shipped back out, the blue fuel and refined petroleum. After the fall of the Soviet Union, Russia continued this practice and sells fuel to its periphery state below market. In the case of Ukraine, 30% below the European market price, as long as Ukraine remains pro-Russian. And the deal is very explicit.
And how pro-Russian? What does that mean, remain
pro-Russian? Well, so the ruler is a guy named Yanukovych at the moment. And after the Orange Revolution, he was overthrown in favor of a reformist regime. Some of the leaders of that regime are now in prison, charged with a remarkable crime of abuse of state resources by having paid too much for Russian gas. Because as soon as they took over, the Russians hiked up the price. In 2010, Yanukovych came back into power. That's in 2011. He threw a woman named Yulia Tymoshenko into prison. She was a very colorful figure, a leading figure in the Orange Revolution. She has this long blonde braid and very photogenic, very popular. She's now in prison with severe health problems. The EU's outrage over her treatment is one of the things that broke an earlier initiative back in 2011 of an outreach to Ukraine, causing Ukraine to enter into an Eastern European consortium. And once again, Yanukovych, literally on the eve of signing an agreement with the European Union in Vilnius, a large agreement which would have opened free trade and considerable investment, backed out at the last moment. And the explanation is very straightforward. He's answering to his Russian masters. What makes the case so interesting is that at least substantial numbers, very substantial numbers of people in Ukraine are not willing to accept that outcome. That got a little garbled. The broad version is Ukraine is ruled by a very pro-Russian kleptocrat.
I like that term, kleptocrat. That's great.
It's absolutely true.
A good Russian tradition. Take what you can get.
Absolutely. And massive corruption and massive inefficiency have made Ukraine's economic progress desperately poor. It is the one economic agency whose reports I was reading recently called it the most disappointing case in all of Eastern Europe. In order to maintain those close ties with Russia, Russia on multiple prior occasions has simply closed the taps, cut off all natural gas into Ukraine in the middle of winter. They did it in 2009. Very, very picturesquely, in 2009, Russian television actually broadcast the manager ordering the guys to turn the giant wheel to stop the pipe.
And as all, punishment for...
It was a pricing dispute, but basically as punishment for the Ukrainians asserting too much independence in their dealings with Russia. Mm-hmm. Russia seeks to have a kind of an empire. It's a sphere...
Again,
a regional sphere in which they are hegemonic. It's what they call the near abroad. It's basically the post-Soviet states, the ring of states circling the Russian border. And their power for doing that is control over those refined fuel products. I started to mention earlier that Russia sells these products below market. They do that in order that there's no incentive for those other countries to build their own refining capacity, which is very expensive.
It keeps them dependent.
It keeps them dependent. So Russia's been playing this game for some time now, and events in Ukraine are suggesting that it might finally be failing.
And why this push to become part of the EU? What would that mean for Ukraine?
Well, Ukrainians hope it would mean serious anti-corruption efforts, a boost to the economy, large-scale European investment, freedom to study at European universities, freedom of travel across the EU, and a whole bunch of other things of that sort. But really, all of that is secondary. There is a battle going on between the Russian side and the European side in Armenia and Azerbaijan and Moldova and Ukraine and all of these countries. And it's really as simple as that, which side will be dominant. Russia wants to create a Eurasian Union. They want all of these countries to join the current customs union, which is Russia, Kazakhstan, and Belarus, to form a Eurasian Union to rival the European Union. Economically, that's nonsense.
And there have always been leanings toward the West. I mean, Peter the Great with his window on the West, which became St. Petersburg.
Absolutely. And Peter the Great spoke French in his court and truth be told, thought of Russian culture as rather inferior to the civilization of Paris. Vladimir Putin's a somewhat different kettle of fish. You know, we talk a lot about soft power and hard power these days, and America should use cultural and economic influence. As I mentioned, Ukraine, Russia has lots of influence, lots of ties, lots of deep roots. But Putin is very fond of using hard power, and his weapon of choice is to simply shut off fuel to Northern Europe or Eastern Europe in the middle of winter. The foreign minister of Russia last week said to a Moldovan representative, I certainly hope you don't freeze this winter. And 2 days later, Moldova did sign that European Union accord, the one that Ukraine backed out of.
Why do you think it's failing now, this strategy with Ukraine?
The EU is pushing back hard, which they've never done before.
Why now, do you think?
It's an interesting question. It's a fascinating question. I think part of the answer might be that for a while, the United States really didn't want trouble. We needed our bases in Kyrgyzstan to supply our operations in Afghanistan. We viewed Russia as, I think ally would be really stretching things, but a partner with whom we needed to work. We have and had large-scale private investment in Kazakhstan and oil development there. So this is complete speculation on my part, but I think that the British and the Americans may very well have thought that with Iraq and Afghanistan, there's simply enough going on that please don't make trouble in this region right now.
Is some of it ideological? In other words, how much of it is sort of a push for democracy?
Well, in one sense, quite a lot, but not quite the way that we mean it. Spending time in Central Asia and the post-Soviet states, you know, one of the things that I've learned is you have to translate these terms into the local argo. So it's a push for ending, or at least trying to end, institutionalized statewide top-to-bottom corruption. Now, we think of corruption or anti-corruption efforts in democracy as perhaps related but separate. For these states, they're not separate. It is through corruption that the anti-democratic forces are able to enrich themselves and maintain their power. They use bribes and insider dealing the way our Congress used to use pork barrel spending. if you're familiar with the American 19th century distinction between honest graft and dishonest graft.
And the good old spoils.
And the good old spoils. You know, they are rife with both, but outright criminality. So, for example, the post-Soviet breakup, the first president of Ukraine was a guy named Leonid Kuchma, a thug from the Soviet era of the First Order. I use the term thug advisedly. One of his critics was killed and, in fact, decapitated. Kuchma was going to be put on trial for this, but just hours or days, I think 2 days, I think it was, before the trial, the key witness against him was shot twice in the head.
A little suspicious.
These things happen. Yeah. It was his former prime minister. It really is. I mean, I hesitate. I blush to paint this in quite such black and white terms. But Kuchma and now Yanukovych, these guys are thugs and kleptocrats, and they are the creatures of Vladimir Putin.
And who organized the hundreds of thousands of people protesting? Who's behind it? Like, who's leading it and organizing it?
That's a really good question. The popular reports coming out are, well, it's spontaneous and Twitter helped. Mm-hmm. I'm sure some truth to that.
Like the Arab Spring.
Like the Arab mm-hmm. Spring. I'm sure there's some truth to that. It's funny you should mention the Arab Spring. I'll come back to that in a minute. It's singularly relevant here. There is, after all, a tradition of holding mass demonstrations in that square. One of the really interesting things in the Orange Revolution is, there's been some very good work analyzing how that happened and how it succeeded, is that key elite figures began to abandon Yanukovych. And it's happening again. The chief of staff of his government has resigned. Two members of parliament have resigned and quit his party. Mayors and governors are starting to distance themselves. If you're Yanukovych or one of his supporters, the thing that should be alarming you as much as the size and scale of the protests, which are huge, is the fact that this early in the game, elite players are starting to back off. There's a billionaire who runs a television station who's given the protesters access to the airwaves. That's an incredibly telling sign because if you lose the oligarchs, it's not quite like Russia. In Russia, if Putin is crossed by an oligarch, the oligarch ends up in prison. In Ukraine, the oligarchs have a bit more independent power by virtue of their wealth. And so Yanukovych is losing both on the street and there are at least some indications that he's starting to lose traction among the elites. That puts him in a weak position. That puts Russia in a weak position. And Russia has shown in the past, not at the risk of repeating myself, that confronted by that possibility, the possibility of an encroachment into their sphere by the EU, they are perfectly willing and capable of responding in extremely harsh terms.
And Ukraine would not have any recourse at all, any market at any price?
Well, at the moment. So another part of the answer to what has changed is that the European Union is building pipelines. One across the Baltic Sea, one from Romania into Moldova. So Moldova is the other transit state that I mentioned. There's pipelines going into Europe. The third one is Georgia, which has pipelines heading south toward the Middle East. You may remember that Russia invaded Georgia in 2008. That was what was at stake, was control over those pipelines. I once wrote an essay in which I described it as less an iron curtain than an iron web. Those pipelines are how Russia controls its sphere as mm-hmm. much as anything else. So the European Union is working on developing alternatives. At the moment, however, for this coming winter, if Russia closes the pipes, next month, lots of people in Moldova, lots of people in Ukraine, and lots of people in Europe are going to get very cold very fast.
They do supply much of Europe, too.
They supply an enormous amount of Europe's natural gas, especially also a good deal of its oil.
And what about the United States? To what extent are we just standing back and watching, and to what extent is there any attempt to influence what's happening?
Well, I have to say that a good deal of what I'm describing has happened so fast, just in the last 5 days. I'm not sure there's been time for the U.S. to take a role. In general, we are very passive in that region. We needed our air bases in Kyrgyzstan. You may remember that a couple of years ago, Kyrgyzstan threatened to shut them down at the end of a lease, and we had to give them some concessions. As is so often the case, running a large-scale trans-global venture like the Iraq War or the Afghanistan War involves getting into bed with some unsavory characters, and you have to take cooperation where you can get it. One of the consequences of that and other things an exhausted U.S. economy and an extended military, is that we have not nationally been a very active presence in that region. So right now, this is really between the EU and Russia. The United States did nothing when Russia invaded Georgia, and Russia noticed that.
Mm. You mentioned the Arab Spring, that there were some interesting parallels. How so?
Well, not so much an interesting parallel, although there is some connection. So the Arab Spring started in large part, or it's a significant part, among a young generation that faced high unemployment, poor economic prospects, a decline in government pay. The public sector in Egypt especially was a very large sector of the economy, and frustration with corruption, you know, all those things together. All of those things are true in Ukraine as well, particularly the corruption and the dour economic outlook. What I was really thinking of was something interesting that happened in the fall of 2011. In the fall of 2011, Russia held very large-scale war games, in which Ukraine was involved, as was Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, and not China, which is significant.
What do you mean by war games?
Thousands of men, mm-hmm. ships, and planes practicing maneuvers. And the putative reason was to practice fighting against terrorists, but the kinds of things they were practicing were naval landings and aerial attacks. You know,
pretty flimsy rationale.
The day Al-Qaeda gets a battleship, I'll take this you know, much more seriously. One of the really interesting comments was a comment by the Russian chief of staff, who said, "We have been following events in the Arab world very closely. And we will not allow anything like that to break out in our region." And there were other comments, too, to suggest that what was being practiced was a kind of multinational Russian-led regional force to put down any attempt at any kind of, well, I mean, in 2011, the Arab Spring perhaps looked a little differently to us than it does now, but to put down any kind of democracy or reform-oriented
like Czechoslovakia, populism. 1968, Hungary, 1956.
There are precedents, and Georgia in 2008, absolutely. Interestingly, in the past week, 10 days, meeting of the Shanghai summit of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which both Russia and China are members, Li Keqiang, who is the Chinese premier, called for much closer security cooperation to fight the three evils of terrorism, extremism, and separationism. Those are the buzzwords, and I don't think it's at all impossible. I think it's entirely possible that Russia would resort to shutting off the gas to Europe again. I don't think it's at all impossible that an outright military response could occur, particularly given what I take to be Russia's very high level of confidence at the moment, at least, that U.S. reaction will be minimal. That might be wrong, but I think that that's their perception.
And what is this Shanghai Corporation you're talking about?
Sorry, right. So the Shanghai Cooperation Agreement is a large-scale multinational agreement, originally started in 1996 with a different name, but it's been in place that long, so since shortly after the fall of the Soviet Union, that involves, I'm sure I'm going to inadvertently leave some people out, but China, Russia, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and both India and Pakistan have observer status, as do Iran and Afghanistan. So this is it's not at all an exaggeration to say that this was conceived of as a counterweight to NATO.
Sure.
Or CETO,
mm-hmm.
or the combination of the two. In 2000, sort of every 2 years, in 2005, 2007, 2009, there were large-scale war games with all parties. That's why I said it was interesting that in 2011 China was left out. They were invited to observe, but they didn't participate. That relates to the relationship between Russia and China.
Which always is fascinating.
Always fascinating.
And we'll talk about that when we continue in a moment with the University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Howard Schwaber, and we're talking about Russia, China, and future relations with the U.S. We've been talking mostly about Russia and the protests in Kiev, the sort of leverage back and forth over the EU and the oil and so on. And you mentioned the fact that China had been left out of the Shanghai, the war games kind of that were going on. What is the relationship right now between Russia and China? You've got these two superpowers, both in a sort of problematic relationship with the U.S. What about the relationship between them?
Well, I should be clear. Those were not Shanghai Cooperation Organization war games.
Okay.
To have held a war game under that aegis and leave China out is impossible. There's another – I mean, there are all of these multiple overlapping international agencies organizations. It's a little bit like the situation in certain regions in Africa. In 2007, something called the Collective Security Treaty Organization was formed, which is sort of the members of the Shanghai Cooperation Agreement without the observers and without China. And that's who held these war games. They're called the Center 2011 War Games.
And these are like an economic union?
That one's military.
Military.
There's also an economic union, which I mentioned earlier, that currently consists or comprises a customs union of Russia, Kazakhstan, and Belarus. And Russia would very much like to see that expanded to be something to be called the Eurasian Union. There have been dozens of different proposals and different permutations, but that's the current one. That's significant because the creation of that customs union, which was only finalized last year or 2011, 2012, meant that goods no longer flow freely across the border from China into Kazakhstan and from there into the Russian Federation. So that was a bit of a blow
to Kazakhstan.
No, to China. Kazakhstan. Well, to people who live in that region of Kazakhstan, certainly, and to many Kazakhs, sure. But in terms of the national economy, it opened up more trade with Russia because there are now no customs duties for trades within that customs organization. Although I can tell you that the planes from Urumqi, which is in western China, into Almaty, which is in Kazakhstan, it's sort of like riding on a second-class train carriage in Egypt. Every bit of space is filled with packages and bundles and carpets and rugs. So there's sort of an unofficial, small-scale trade going on anyway. But the border is now not open in the way that it was. The relationship, of course, between China and Russia has lengthy history. And it does seem now fairly clear, partly from the things I mentioned and partly from other things, that Russia and China have reached both a tacit and an explicit agreement. Each wants to be dominant in a particular sphere. For China, that's the South China Sea, the area in which off eastern China, in which this air defense zone has been declared, and a kind of set of buffer countries, Laos, Cambodia, Myanmar, in some ways North Korea. For Russia, it's the near abroad. And each is willing to cede to the other hegemony within that sphere. Outside of those spheres, there's a competition for influence. And China's actions outside of its area of regional hegemony are purely economic. And they're enormous. Just in the past week, agreements have been signed for China to build a railway from Budapest to Belgrade and another one inside of Romania. China is building a pipeline to carry oil from Iran across Pakistan into western China and helping to build a port in Quetta in Pakistan. China has just purchased a $5 billion stake sold by ConocoPhillips in western Kazakhstan oil fields. And there is no competition from America or from the European Union for that scale of investment because, let's face it, at the moment we just don't have the money.
And neither does Russia.
Yeah, neither does Russia.
How does Russia feel about that?
Neither does Russia, which is why Russia depends a little bit more on military presence and a little bit less on economic presence. So there's that other – China and Russia seem to have each agreed to mutually allow one another to be hegemonic in their spheres, and then beyond that they have different styles of doing things. For example, one of the observations that was made during the discussions about chemical weapons in Syria and the way Putin stepped up and was able to make Russia a central player and America back down, one of the observations of that was that plays very well for Putin presenting Russia as a stable partner for places like China, who have big interests in the Middle East but no military force projected there. We tend to forget that Russia has a naval base in Syria, a port on the Syrian coast. That's a very major interest for them, and it gives them a very distinct presence there. That's a piece that gets left off of out of the discussions far too often.
They love those warm water ports.
You got to love those warm water ports, and their other one is in, you guessed it, Ukraine. And in 2011, one of the things Russia demanded in return for not turning off the gas, was a new 25-year lease on the port in Sevastopol for its Ukrainian fleet.
It's hard not to get cynical. It sounds like such maneuvering, almost like the game of Battleship or something. It's just fighting over territory and relations and so on. You step back from it a bit, it makes you a little cynical. Can you talk about the recent disputes over the air zone and the dispute with Japan over certain islands?
Sure. I think you have to go back just a little bit. I mean, let me respond to your comment about cynicism. I'm not sure what you mean by becoming cynical.
Okay.
We're talking about a field of study in which Hobbes is frequently cited as an inspiration. I agree it's hard not to see this as the revival of the great game of the competing empires, you know. And the withdrawal of the United – no, withdrawal is much too strong. The diminished presence of the United States. You know, there was a period not that long ago when people were talking about a unipolar world and the United States would have the will and the capacity to extend its influence and project force anywhere in the world. Well, not so much.
That takes a lot of money anyway.
It takes a vast amount of money and a vast amount of resources.
We're very much in debt to China.
That's part of our – that's one of our problems. I mean, we have lots of problems. Mm-hmm. We have – politically, we're disinclined to draw on the resources that we have. We won't raise taxes, even to promote American greatness, if you want to phrase it that way, or, you know, whatever the phrasing would turn out to be. It's not that we lack money. We have a $16 trillion economy. Russia's, by contrast, is $2.5 trillion. But they are much more willing to spend their money publicly on projecting themselves into the world than we are, for better or for worse. We're also rather overextended and I think both politically and strategically rather exhausted. We're also far away. Very little of this has gotten much attention in the American press in the last few days, despite the fact that these are potentially earth-shaking events. I mean, if the numbers really are on the order of a million people in the streets of Kiev, and we know they've taken over government buildings, and we know that senior government officials are resigning, we know there have been protests even in Yanukovych's hometown and other cities across Kiev. This is a pivotal moment in the conflict between Russia and the EU for not so much dominance in the old-fashioned imperial military sense, but for dominant influence in a critical part of the world. Back
after
to China.
All, it used to be called Little Russia.
Indeed. And of course, Russia depended heavily on Ukraine and Kazakhstan for agricultural products and resources. It would be a devastating loss for Russia to lose influence over Ukraine. Turning to China, we have to go back at least a couple of years when President Obama announced his pivot to Asia. That's another thing we don't talk about much in the United States anymore. But, for example, I was in Australia not long ago, and there it was a very, very current topic of conversation. We said we would put, I think 1,500 was the number of Marines in Darwin, and they're not there yet. And the Australians are nervous about that. The Australians talk about a triangle relationship with China and the United States. So China sees the United States, particularly after Obama's declaration that we are going to focus more on Asia than we have in the past, as contesting its desire for hegemony. I said that for Russia, it's all about pipelines. For China, it's about trade routes, it's sea lanes, and control over the waterways. And Japan has elected Abe, who's a bit of a nationalist. And China sees Japan as more assertive. So to a certain extent, China is responding to what it sees as assertiveness from potential rivals. It's also the case, however, that China has just become much more aggressive and much more nationalistic. Yet another thing that happened in the last, I think, 48 hours, although I'm starting to lose track because things are happening so fast, China has launched a rocket to the moon. If the mission is successful, it will land and release a robot rover on the moon. They have sent their first and thus far only aircraft carrier into the disputed waters in the territory that we're talking about. And that air defense zone that they're claiming includes two islands that Japan claims. And it's probably worth mentioning that the United States is bound by a joint defense treaty signed in 1952 with Japan to defend those islands in the event of any hostile action.
And do those islands have mineral resources?
They have absolutely nothing of any value to anyone as far as I know.
So it's a symbolic
as far as I know, fight. Yes. This one seems to be symbolic. But symbolism counts a lot for countries like Russia and China.
Yes, it does. And face. There are other islands that they dispute, too, with
absolutely,
Japan.
Absolutely. Sakhalin's
there. Yeah,
but these two
are
right in the crosshairs of this particular air defense zone. It's not remotely a coincidence.
And stepping back from it and trying to look very objectively at who has a claim to those islands, who has the better claim?
It would take a team of international lawyers, a linguist, and a Ouija board.
Okay.
Both sides have very long-standing claims with all kinds of different agreements and treaties that they can point to.
What about the U.S. reaction that we started the hour with? Does that seem like a, gosh, we don't care anyway, we're
we're okay with it?
I know it's always fashionable to bash our countrymen or our media as not, or our politicians as not paying attention. This time it seems to be entirely deserved. I haven't seen an American reaction. President Obama, of course, expressed concern over the Chinese declaration of an air security zone. The United States sent planes, including a couple of B-52s, yeah, into that zone. Yesterday, China scrambled military aircraft in response, and the United States, as we heard in the opening, has now advised all planes to give China advance notice before flying through the territory, which is kind of a step back.
Right.
But I have not heard any American reaction to what's going on in Ukraine. And more generally, I have not heard any American reaction to Russia's threats over the last 2 weeks to freeze Moldova into submission if it forms an agreement with the EU, or to close its borders to all Moldovan imports, or even this is not an official threat by the Russian government, but there have been talk that the Russians might resort to expelling tens of thousands of Moldovans from Russia. These are brutal measures we're talking about, and the United States is very noticeably absent.
And would you, going back to your idea that Russia and China are sort of allowing the other one to have hegemony over a certain region, presumably then Russia is taking no stand whatsoever about the China-Japan dispute? It makes no difference to them?
So far, dead silence. Mm-hmm. No, that's exactly right. And I think there is zero chance. If we imagine that situation gets more and more tense and more occupying for China, you know, in a different world, you might think Russia would take advantage of that opportunity to assert some of its own claims. After all, Russia and China have lots of disputed claims, yeah, with one another. I think there's zero possibility, a chance of that happening.
And how much overlap is there right now in the economies of China and Japan? How much trade between them? How much interaction?
Quite substantial. I saw the number just this morning, and I have to confess I don't remember it, but I think it's on the order of $20 billion. There is substantial trade back and forth between China and Japan. China could live without that trade, I think, much more easily than Japan could.
I was just trying to figure out kind of the leverage on either side and who stood to gain from this dispute over the islands.
I don't think that in the case of that dispute that it comes down to economics in that way. I think it comes down to much more old-fashioned geopolitical strategy and control of the ocean. Of course, in the long run, if you control the ocean... So one of China's concerns is resource security, food security and fuel security,
right,
which is one of the reasons, for example, there have been very large-scale purchases of farmland in Africa and some in Australia, although no one knows exactly how much. China worries about food security, having reliable access to resources to feed its people, just as basic as that. And that's one of the reasons they want control over those waterways so badly. Again, this is something that I think as Americans we have a little trouble sympathizing with. But most countries in the world are not food secure. Mm-hmm. And food security has become a really major issue in international politics. I should say in the medium run, or certainly the long run, China's position is a lot stronger than Russia's in all this. The countries that have remained loyal to Russia have seen far lower rates of economic development than those that have been able to cast their lot with the EU, as well as, and not coincidentally, far higher levels of corruption, far lower levels of political freedoms, press freedoms, and all those sorts of things. I don't think there's any long-term prospect for Russia to be able to keep up its empire for very long. But in the short term, and by short term, I mean, you know, let's talk 5 to 10 years. So it's not that short. Mm-hmm. I do see these two spheres, and each of the major players, Russia and China, competing in response to perceived challenges to their authority over those spheres.
What effect do you think the new energy independence in the United States has in our thinking in all of this?
Potentially quite a lot, and it's not just the U.S. So let me go back to Ukraine again, which I really think is the best story to illustrate what's going on in that whole situation. It turns out that in western Ukraine, there is a large amount of shale gas, and we now have the technology to extract that gas. It's environmentally somewhat controversial technology. We're talking about, among other things, about fracking.
Yeah.
And I suppose I'm torn. How does one balance the issues of environmental degradation against the possibility of getting out from under the domination of Russia, a domination enforced in the most brutal and direct possible fashion? By the same token, you know, the United States is either has just become or is about to become the largest oil exporting country World. It is hard to believe. We all remember not that
1973.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. We remember not that long ago, we were all being told the United States will forever be, in thraldom to our overlords to control our energy supplies. Mm-hmm. And the only solution will be to all go solar, which is still a very valid debate, mm-hmm. and one well worth having. But change in technology and availability of energy resources radically change the balance of power, because that is what Russia has. The ability to shut off that critical resource
makes them even more vulnerable. Then,
in the long run, it does. Time is not on their side in lots of ways.
What about cyber wars, information technology? I would assume that maybe China and Japan in that sphere would be much more involved in that than.
The Russians play cyber war, and they play hardball. It's not as though there's a shortage of Russian scientists and computer engineers. cyber war is, especially the Chinese though.
But you never hear about Russians hacking in and pirating.
There's quite a lot of that, particularly in Europe. I think the Russians may target their efforts more on Europe and less in the United States, and the Chinese target the United States more, which may be why we hear more about China. But Russia engages – well, all major industrialized countries, including us, engage in those activities. But Russia is very active.
What about Russia and China in terms of spying on each other, using technology in those ways against each other?
Well, that's a good question. And I have to confess, I have no idea. I'm not sure anybody does. I'm not sure anyone who does is going to be able to tell us.
Or they will be banished.
Or they might not be telling us anything for very long. There are places. Pakistan is one case that comes to mind where both Russia and China are vying for influence. I mean, it's not that they never compete with each other. Within their spheres, they will leave one another, alone to deal with their enemies. But out there in the world, they're perfectly happy to be competitive. I think, these are two different stories, and we should, of course, get to the U.S. role in all this. But, the Russian story is a story about force and empire and a direct conflict for influence and control over that central part between Europe and Asia, Eastern Europe, Central Asia. The Chinese story is much more, I think, one about regional control, but a global economic empire that is spreading and growing very fast in all kinds of different directions.
What part does the incredible debt that the United States owes to China play in those politics, do you think?
Well, one of the stories that didn't get perhaps as much attention as it ought to have was that in 2008, when the United States was trying to decide whether to take action, the first Bush bailout that Secretary Paulson brought to Congress, you may remember, it was a massive bailout. The original Paulson version was about 18 lines long. It was sort of, give me an enormous amount of money and trust me. That Congress eventually demanded more than that. And you remember that fantastic scene of counting the votes on Congress. And I remember on the television screen, they had a stock ticker. And you could just watch the market falling minute by minute as they were waiting to get the votes. And it fell something like 1,000 points in less than 2 hours. One of the things that happened was that there was a somewhat infamous conversation in which a senior Chinese government official said to an American official, we could sell a lot of your bonds all at once. Or people are suggesting this would be a good time for us to dump your bonds. But of course, we won't do that, which is a very nice way of saying, boy, we could really do that. It's a weapon. Mm-hmm. It's an exceedingly powerful weapon.
How did we get there?
Cheap goods.
We wanted to in 1980, we were the world's largest creditor nation. By 1990, we were the world's largest debtor nation. Somewhere in the decade of the 1980s, we completely lost all control of the relationship with between the money that we spent and the money that we brought in. We vastly increased spending, we vastly decreased taxes, and we borrowed the difference. It's a very, very short version. And the people who were there to lend it to us were the Chinese, who were maintaining their own very favorable balance of trade by deliberately depressing their currency. China has its challenges. I've seen an estimate by the Sino-Economic Research Institute that suggests that municipalities and regional governments in China are carrying mostly illegal debt to the tune of 65% of national GDP. China has huge structural problems, these massive urbanization and privatization projects that they're engaged in, these building of cities and the farmland and so on, could be disasters. So, you know, this is by no means a triumphalist and deterministic story that we must all bow to our Chinese overlords. But internationally, they're playing a power game, and that U.S. debt that they hold is their nuclear weapon.
What is the U.S. role in all of this, and what should it be? More on that when we continue with University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Howard Schwaber, and we're talking about Russia, China, and future relations with the U.S. It seems that the U.S. is more of an active player when it comes to China than with Russia. What's your sense of the direction we should be heading?
Well, that's certainly my perception, and that was my perception when I was there. The U.S. seemed very distant and very uninvolved. And I think that that's I don't think it's overstating it to say that that's tragic. Europe is still our biggest trading partner, Europe and Canada. The European Union is the group of states, again, along with Canada and Great Britain, but it is the largest group of states in the world that share our interests and our values. And I think that there is a major conflict, a sort of Cold War Part 2B or whatever we're up to, being fought for domination of a large swath of very important territory that sits between the EU and Russia. And I find it short-sighted at best for the United States to act as though it has no stake in that outcome and to act, sort of leave it to the EU to stand up to Russian pressure in this way. Now, there are lots of reasons for that. There's an isolationist streak in our current politics, particularly on the right. There's also an isolationist streak on the left, but they are much less represented in Congress. There is the matter of a feeling of fiscal exhaustion and this absolute unwillingness to raise revenues, even if we were all to agree that the purpose was worthwhile. There is the overhanging problem of the debt we've already assumed. There is the exhaustion of our adventures in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I don't use that term to belittle those endeavors, but they are large-scale draining endeavors of, as the saying goes, blood and treasure. So it's completely understandable that the American public, as well as American politicians, are not eager to find themselves drawn into a potential conflictual relationships. There are also lots of American businesses that have business interests. I mentioned Western Kazakhstan. There are lots of American businesses that have interests in Russia. Nonetheless, it does seem to me that there are incredibly important U.S. strategic interests, long-term interests, that would require us to want to be active participants in helping places like Ukraine and Moldova and Armenia turn to Europe and the West rather than to Russia as the source of their identity and their security and trade.
What about the old sphere of influence concept, though?
Well, I hate to sound like someone who's, you know, broken open a 1975 international relations textbook and say, hey, look, there's a picture. So I don't want to go quite that far. For one thing, the EU is the major player here, not the United States. We would be in a supporting role under any circumstances. So it's a very different world. But yeah, there is something to that, I think, in the sense that in places like Central Asia and Eastern Europe, the people on the ground see themselves as in play and see themselves as torn between and drawn between two possible poles. And those two poles feel roughly equal. I mean, we think of the United States as vastly richer, bigger, and more powerful than Russia. And in one sense, that's true. It's also very far away. In terms of, you know, ability to exert influence right there on the spot, Russia is the big immediate presence. The European Union is not far away and is just, I mean, in the last couple of years, starting to make its presence felt. And the United States is sort of busy with other things. Mm. So, you know, it's all very well to have wealth and power. If you want to influence events in the world, then you have to find ways to put them to work.
Anything interesting that we should be watching for in terms of the upcoming Olympics?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things we haven't talked about, except I think perhaps very briefly in passing, are Russia's security concerns. Just yesterday, the Moscow police captured 15 terrorists with suicide bombs in Moscow. It seems slightly surprising that a cell that large and that heavily equipped could have managed to plant itself in Moscow.
What kind of terrorist? After what?
Well, the group in question is affiliated with Al-Qaeda.
That's always a flash word, isn't it?
It is a flash word. Russia and the post-Soviet governments in general are petrified of radical Islam. In the southern part of the Soviet Union, places like Chechnya, there were always Kazakhstan is primarily an Islamic country. It's always been the case that the Soviet Union included a very, very large number, an enormously large number of Muslims. And so it's not entirely unreasonable for those governments to fear that radical Islam could become a potent and dangerous force, as it has become in Pakistan, for example. I can make an interesting comparison here, which is that I've spoken with Pakistani Islamists who say, you know, we must impose strict religious law because it's the only way to get rid of corruption. You know, if you have rampant corruption in a largely Muslim population, there is a ready-made narrative. And so, you know, perhaps they are right to be afraid of these things. It's also the case the Olympics are being held in Sochi, which is in the Caucasus. It's a very, very dangerous area surrounded by unsettled territories.
Why did they end up being held there? I mean, if that was known that this was a dangerous area.
That's a fascinating question, and I have absolutely no idea.
Okay.
although I gather they're trying to build an entirely new facility and having some troubles doing it, but perhaps this was a justification for a large-scale development project that they thought would help them then solidify their hold over the area. Who knows? But I thought it was interesting, for example, that the police that captured these terrorists took pains to mention that they believe that their bases are in mountains in Georgia.
Where the Russians could, of course, take care of the threat.
As was regretfully necessary in Chechnya,
yes.
Sure, if it has to be done. So there is, I mean, there are both real security risks and, I mentioned earlier the premier of China mentioning terrorism, separatism, and extremism as the threats against which all these countries must be vigilant. It's also a very good reason to crack down if you feel the need to crack down. China faces its own threats, so they're not really of the same scale. China's big problems are the Uyghur population, who are Muslim, Turkic-speaking peoples in the western part of China, among whom there is a separatist movement. There's no history of Uyghurs engaging in, you know, setting off bombs in Shanghai or any kind of terrorism.
How big a population are we talking about? I mean, China's already got a billion-plus people to deal with.
When you're talking about 1.3 billion people, the numbers get large very, very quickly. I believe we're talking about a few million, although I have to confess I'm not 100% positive on that. You know, you knew we had reached a certain level of absurdity when it was revealed that the United States was holding several Uyghurs in Guantanamo Bay because the Chinese government had declared them to be terrorists. This is true.
Really? Yeah. So, again, you use that flash word and we'll react.
Use that flash word and we will react. And more to the point, if you use that flash word as a justification for action, no one, including us, is terribly – I mean, certainly no one is going to say, well, that's not a good reason to act. And conversely, we're all going to err on the side of assuming that the threat is real for obvious reasons.
And that action is a good thing.
And that action is a good thing. So it is an interesting bit of leverage as well as a genuine concern for the Russians. I have to confess, in the Chinese case, I think it's almost entirely a
like a fabrication?
Thank you. A manufactured concern.
What about Mongolia?
Mongolia is a very interesting case. So China is investing in Mongolia quite extensively. There are – to the tune of $2 billion thus far, and Mongolia has just announced a 10-year set of public projects to the tune of $50 billion, which China is expected to take up about $10 billion. So, in terms of Mongolian economy, a very large investment, a very large influence. Russia is fine with that, I think, as long as there's no hint of military involvement. It's interesting because China quite frequently has to put down disorder or insufficient order, let's say, in Inner Mongolia, the portion of Mongolia within its borders,
right.
But has shown no indication whatsoever of an interest in crossing that border. And I think that perfectly captures the relationship that Russia and China are maintaining along that very, very long frontier.
They kind of enjoy that buffer zone of Outer Mongolia.
They do a bit. Mm-hmm. And Mongolia is an interesting place. They also have some resources and a growing economy. They are the coldest capital city in the world, which was a matter of some resentment for Astana because we had the second coldest capital city in the world. We did get to 50 below, which I thought was pretty cold. But
what about North Korea and the effect that it has on both Russia and China? the presence of
absolutely
a threat there.
Absolutely. So China is the only country that asserts and seems to have the ability to exercise at least some influence over North Korea. And China maintains that relationship for its purposes. Aside from the debt we owe China, aside from very extensive Chinese investments in the United States, which, by the way, is the one security against the Chinese threat to dump American bonds that would harm their own investments in the United States. So there's a line of thinking, sort of pro-globalization line of thinking that says what we should do is get the Chinese to buy as many assets as possible. Detroit, I hear, is a lovely
town. Yeah, right. We're offering a special.
But one of the other points of leverage that China likes to hold on to is, well, we can deal with North Korea. And, of course, North Korea has nuclear nukes, and you wouldn't want anything bad to happen. And it's kind of a half-threat, half-promise. We can deal with North Korea, and besides, it'd be a shame if something terrible happened to South Korea, wouldn't it? that's why earlier I mentioned North Korea as sort of part of China's buffer. There is always the potential that China will lose patience with North Korea's fundamentally insane leadership.
Genetically insane.
Well, it's quite possible, though. That's not my field.
One generation after the next.
Mm-hmm. As we look ahead to the next year or so, what do you want to take a crystal ball, few-minute prediction for where things are going to head on both fronts?
I think given that the direction the Obama administration has taken, and also, the political position it's in, the need, I think, that the president and the administration feel to show they stand up to their commitments, some of those political calculations, I think the United States will continue to be very actively present in Japan and Australia, or around Japan and in Australia. And that will make that Chinese area a flashpoint. I don't think the Chinese have any interest in getting into a shooting war in the United States anytime in the near future. And so I certainly wouldn't see that happening. But I'd expect to see ongoing little things, perhaps a plane shot down, perhaps some ships naval incursions, for a while yet. I don't want to blame the Obama administration, because Congress as well and both national parties have shown zero interest in focusing on Eastern Europe and Central Asia. And I have to expect that the United States will continue to simply not be involved there for multiple reasons, including sheer inability to be everywhere all at once. U.S. businesses are playing an important role in investing in energy development. If U.S. businesses, for example, or U.S. and European businesses were brought in to develop fuel resources in Western Ukraine, that would make an important role. But over the next short term, next year, 2 years, let's say between now and 2016, I expect the United States to continue its current, in my view, very unfortunate posture of not asserting a strong interest in the outcome in those areas. And I think that gives Russia a real opportunity to try and solidify its hold. The question is, how much pain can the EU take? It gets cold in Europe in the winter. Mm-hmm. In 2006 and 2009, there was a threat in 2011. There was a threat as recently as 2013. Russia has played this game of, we will cut off your fuel and you will be shivering in the dark.
So how can the EU compete with Russia when Russia is holding the Trump card?
Well, so the EU needs to develop its own energy independence. Mm-hmm. They need to build pipelines that go from the North Sea areas in Scandinavia down to Europe across the Baltic, which are in progress, but will take a while.
Always does.
To develop energy resources. And it's amazing, we have been fixated for so long in the Middle East because of its energy dominance. Mm-hmm. We're now moving into a phase where another energy dominance is shaping the geopolitics of a critical and very large region of the world. It's amazing how much of our global political interests are driven by the need to depend on others for energy, which makes energy independence right up there at the top of the agenda.
Our guest has been Howard Schwaber. Thanks for enlightening us on some huge issues.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.